Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Dude Therapist. We have Lauren Nicole Johnson on. Lauren is a coach, advisor, and keynote speaker. She works with CEOs, professional athletes, and Fortune 500 companies through one-on-one coaching workshops and international speaking engagements. Lauren received her master's degree in performance psychology and has worked with various individuals and organizations, including the New York Yankees, U.S. Women's National Soccer Team, Google, Johnson & Johnson, Mass Mutual, Square, the FBI, and many others. Lauren's practical, straightforward advice and mental performance strategies helps individuals become elite decision makers because her belief is you become elite by choice, not by chance. In this week's episode, we're going to talk about how to be and perform at your best. We all need it. We all need tips. We all need tools. I know I learned so much from this episode. So as always, let's get right into it. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Dude Therapist. You have no idea how excited I am to have Lauren on the show because I've been like watching her stuff for the past 2-3 years as a massive New York Yankee fan. You know, as someone who's now in the mental health world, seeing the power of people like Lauren to impact the sports that you love is so integral to their success. So open your eyes, open your ears, open your mind, because today is going to be a really interesting conversation about motivation, inspiration when it comes to the how to perform when it's bottom of the ninth, base is loaded, and your heart's pounding through your chest, but you still got to hit that ball or pitch. So I'm super excited to have Lauren on. She's not just about sports. She's about motivation, inspiration, any other way. So Lauren, thank you so much for being on the show. Could you introduce yourself before I just don't stop talking about how excited I am to have you on?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I am so excited to be here. I've been looking forward to this for months now. And let's see here. Who am I? I am a mom. I am a wife. I am a sister. I am a daughter. I'm a friend. I happen to work in the mental performance space, and I work with professional athletes, Fortune 500 companies, CEOs, just on helping them to leverage their mind to achieve consistent performance. Mm.
How did you, because, you know, for me, when I was going through undergrad, right, I'd never heard of sports performance as a thing. Now, I grew up in the 90s. Mental health was never spoken about as much as it is today, right? Obvious. We all followed sports. It's not like a new thing. Sports and gladiators and that entertainment has been around forever. When did like the sports performance become a priority of sports? I know mental health has been becoming a priority of sports because of amazing athletes speaking up. But how long has it been that sports performance, because everyone just talks about like the A's and like Billy Bean and like all the numbers, but that has nothing to do with this. So when did that start becoming a thing?
Yeah, it's still a pretty new field. From my understanding, it was more so like in the 80s when it started becoming a thing, but it was still so new. Like, you know, you had like the people at the very beginning, like Dr. Ken Revizza and many others that really started out. And a lot of it actually happened to be in baseball. And it is now expanded. And I didn't even know it was a thing until my senior year of undergrad, college. And so I actually thought I was going to be a physical therapist because I was like, okay,
I hear that a lot about people.
You know why though? This is actually why it was for me and why I think it is for a lot of people is I was a high performing athlete, but not enough to like, you know, go on and be like the next so-and-so in my sport. You know, I played soccer, but I was never, you know, good enough to play at a very, very high level, but I played, you know, D1 in college and D2. So I recognized when my college career was over, I was done, but my desire was to stay in sport. Like, how can I still stay in sport? Cause I love it so much. So I thought, you know, the closest way to stay in it is physical therapy. Well, it was my senior year of college, third game into my senior year playing soccer. And I received my fifth concussion and I was told, you know, it's not safe for you to play anymore. And it was, you know, that whole thing, it was devastating, identity crisis, you know, all those things. However, I was kind of bored, you know, still part of the team, just not on the field, but I decided to take an elective course and I found a course in sports psychology. And I'm not kidding. I was the only person to sign up for the course. So the teacher was like, no offense, but I'm not coming to class for you. This is going to be independent study now. But I felt just completely in love with it. And I had this like moment, this like epiphany where I went, who would I have been if I would have known these things? Mm. And then I thought, how many people can I help now that I do? And that's what led me to pursue the next step, which was getting a master's degree in performance and sports psychology.
I love that moment, by the way, you know, because to me, I think most, I'm not here to bash careers and other people. We can if we want to have some fun, but most people in the helping world have had moments like, this is it. Because you don't go into the helping world, and I do consider sports performance a helping world because you're helping humans. Mm-hmm. It's not just because they have to perform and make billions of dollars to keep, you know, sports alive. That's not what it is. It's helping a human. And I feel that whether it's a doctor, whether it's nurses, whether it's NPs, PAs, therapists, mental professionals, coaches, sports performance, you know, world, it's this aha moment of that's it. I felt that. You know, you just said something that really kind of gave me some goosebumps of if only I knew this. What did you learn in that beginning stages? Not yet, but in that beginning stages that you went, oh, I wish someone would have told me this.
That I had more control than I felt I did. Mm. I felt like I was at the mercy of my feelings versus... No. You can feel that way, but your actions don't have to follow the feelings. Like your feelings are not a prerequisite to performance. Your feelings don't, and actions don't have to match to coexist. And I didn't understand that at the time. I allowed my feelings to be such a director in my life. Mm-hmm. And because of that, my worthiness came from my results. Mm. And so I now call it, you know, temporary worthiness. Like what I realized is my worth was so dependent on my results that my worth was so temporary because results are temporary. So when I was performing well, man, I was on cloud nine. But the second my performance suffered, it's like I almost questioned, like, should I even be doing this? Am I good enough? Like, should I just quit? Like, I suck at this. And it was like, there was never this medium in between. It was like all or nothing. And so what it forced me to do, I guess a benefit of it is I was a really hard worker. Like I worked my tail off. Like I didn't go to parties. Like I wasn't like the typical college, you know, student. I was super, super into my sport. So on like Saturday nights when everyone was partying, like I was at the gym and on my way home, I'd pick people up, like, you know, and drive them home, you know, like that was like what I did. But I realized that the driver behind it had less to do with performance and more to do with worthiness. And when I understood that, I understood there was an unsustainable relationship with results. And that was what was holding me back from performing really at my best.
Wow. That's huge.
Yeah, it was.
Like, and I think that a lot of people, whether they're in sports or in anything, are looking to be seen and to be worthy. You know, there was a study done about 2 years ago when it comes to love and relationships. And I'm a relationship specialist, so I was obsessed with this kind of study. It's a very cool thing. That top five for men, number one is to feel worthy in a relationship, to feel seen, to be enough. Number one for women is loved, right? Mm-hmm. And that, I don't know what that actually, depending on woman to woman, man to men, what that actually practically means within the relationship. It doesn't mean that love is not top five on men. It doesn't mean that worthiness is not top five. It is top five for women. But it's so interesting that you're working in a sport that is mostly men and they just want to feel that they're enough. And all the flashiness and all the chains and the money and all that stuff. But in the end, they just want to be told, you got this, I see you. And it's so interesting that when you start looking at sports, when you start really diving into athletes, it's so like I think mind boggling as a fan who doesn't know anything about mental health or what you do. These people play sports for a living. They've been playing for years. This is not just like they picked up a ball and started hitting or throwing or doing whatever sport they're in. They have all the skill, better than most humans on this planet, but it comes to a free throw and they can't hit it. Or it comes to throwing the ball from second to first base. Like Chuck Knoblauch, I remember in the early 2000s, when he just couldn't throw the ball. And it's not the yips, right? It's not like, oh, shoot, like he's been doing this forever. I can do that. And I have no athletic ability like he has. And that's when you start realizing the crossover. Mm-hmm. So can you talk about where skill ends and feelings kind of begin when it comes to someone's actual performance? Because I think people don't understand. People are taking 1,000 shots a day. They should be able to hit an open shot. What the hell? Kind of as a fan. So can you kind of talk about it from more clinical performance based?
Yeah. Yeah. And really quick, I want to make a mention of what you said earlier about the love.
You can make millions of mentions if you'd like.
Yeah, because you struck such a chord with me. I used to equate results to love as a kid. Mm. And so when you said that, I was like, oh, that's me. That's 100% me. Like I felt most loved when I got results in sports.
Can I jump in on that for a second?
Please.
So when I was a kid growing up, my parents were very adamant that I would not feel, and this just happened to me, my parents.
Yeah.
Other parents do the same, do similar things or whatever. It was about trying, not about results. My father was about results more. My mom was about trying. So when I would come home with it, and I have ADHD. I was not good at school. It was just a torturous experience of just performance, that performance part, not trying. It was the performance end. I would come home, let's say, with an 80s something score. And I studied for days, right? My mom would go, did you try? I go, yes. And she'd go, I know you tried. I'm very proud of you. My dad would say, jokingly, because he has a very witty humor, where are the other 10 points? Where are the other 15 points? Later on in life, he stopped doing that. He realized that that wasn't so great. But in reality, he was proud of me because I tried. He just wanted me to try. A lot of cultures or places that are very, especially parents who were in sports, because I've seen this with a few of my clients where their parents were in sports, not that they are pushing them to a certain sport, but the understanding that if you don't win, what did you do?
Yep.
Right? And I remember hearing this really interesting thing from Will Smith's memoir. And I'm a massive Will Smith fan. I have the same ears as him. I grew up in the 90s. I'm obsessed with Will Smith. Even after the slap, I think he's a cool dude. And he said something that when he was growing up, his father would make it seem like the difference between 100 and 99 were miles away. But in reality, it's just one difference. That 100, if you're not 100, you're zero. Mm-hmm. Right? If you're not 100, you're nothing. What 99 is pretty damn close to 100. Or even 90 or 80, whatever you can give that day. And it's such a mind shift. Mm-hmm. So like for most athletes, if you don't score or win, you failed. Like no one's like, good trying, we didn't win the Super Bowl. Good right. trying, we didn't get to the playoffs. Right? It's all about result focused. So that's just something I've always noticed. And we could talk about how we shift that or how you help athletes shift that. But I'd love to talk about the other thing I asked about the performance. I'll put it in the notes and we'll get back to it. I promise.
Well, and I think that there is like a connection.
Go for it.
Because I think that it's not enough to just know your skill and be able to execute that skill. It's, can you do it when it's on, when the game is on the line? Can you do it when it matters most? And so I had a scout actually ask me, he said, you know, I have this player who is so good in practice, but when it comes to performance, like he just struggles. And he's like, Lauren, what's the difference? And I said, well, I like to, like, he said, what happens? And I said, well, I'd like to figure out first, like what doesn't change. And what doesn't change is your ability. So I think that first and foremost is important. Whether you're going from practice to performance or performance to practice, what does not change is your ability to execute. What does change is the circumstances, the pressure, something being on the line, consequences, that's what shifts. And so our ability to manage the pressure that we feel, and it's important to note that the pressure that you feel is directly correlated to how much you care. Mm. You don't care, you're not going to feel a lot of pressure. Mm-hmm. If you care, you're going to experience a lot of it. And so pressure itself is not necessarily good or bad. It's really just a data point that's telling us that something we care about is on the line. Mm-hmm. And our ability to manage the data and the inputs and the circumstances around us, the things that we're feeling, mm-hmm. impacts our ability to behave or execute a skill in the way that we'd like to. That's where those two things really intersect. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times we've seen players that are not as talented excel. And that's why you've also seen players that are insanely talented never reach their full potential. And it's not necessarily because they don't have the skill or the ability, but it's because of the actions they choose in response to the circumstances in front of them. Mm-hmm. And so that's where a lot of times the work that I do comes in, where we teach them really what's happening in your brain and in your body when you're experiencing pressure and what are the things that you can do to manage it. Yeah. Same with when you're lacking confidence, like same with when you're struggling with focus. We dive into those things and then we go, here are some tools and strategies you can use. Because at the end of the day, things like the yips, that's just misplaced focus. I know I'm simplifying the crap out of it and it's not as easy to like execute, but really we're just misplacing our focus and we're looking at something that's really irrelevant and not important in the moment versus focusing on the thing we should be focused on.
Is that like when someone is thinking run before actually catching the ball in football and they drop it because their focus is somewhere else?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's kind of like it's, your mind can exist, is the only thing that can exist in the past, present, and future.
Yeah.
Obviously, our bodies are the only thing. It can only exist in the present. When the best way to visualize this is like, okay, if our mind is not in the present, it's in the past, we're disconnected from our body. Same with mm-hmm. the future. If our mind's in the future, but our body's still in the present, we're disconnected. That's why that mind-body connection is so important in performance, because it doesn't mean that you're not anticipating. It doesn't mean you can't look to the future. But when you're actually performing, if your mind is there, but your body is here, that's where the disconnect happens. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. That's so interesting because, so many fans get so upset and so riled up, of course. And, you know, as someone who's an avid Yankee fan, it was just so funny to see some of these stars of, you know, the amount of money that they were getting to perform and then not is disappointing as a fan. And I'm sure disappointing for the individual as well, right? They're not like, well, I got paid $4 million this year for that swing. And they're upset. They want to do well because that's a value to them. They're not here just for the money. Yes, it's a huge part of it. They're there because they love the game and they're there because they want to win. Right. So how do you teach a team or players to consistently show up when they're not winning, to perform when the team is not doing great, like that season that's kind of like the Yankees this year, right? It's like, okay, you know. How do you help players still stay focused and have the right goals in mind when things are not actually performing the way they can, whether it's in their ability or not?
There's a lot of layers to that question, but I think to answer it, you know, I'll start with this. I hate the phrase fake it till you make it. Like I really dislike it because the word, maybe it's just a personal thing, but the word like fake it, like I'm not good at faking it. Like I am who I am. The way that I feel is always on my sleeve. Like I, you know, for better or for worse, like I don't do well faking things. And so I've kind of reworded that phrase, which is don't fake it till you make it. Learn to behave it regardless of how you feel.
See, I say practice till you make it.
There you go.
That's the thing I tell my clients.
There you go.
Because like if you practice it the way you want to perform, it's not faking it. You're trying to prepare for the game time opportunity, right. You know?
Right. Well, and I think in these situations to help people perform when things are not going well, it's choosing your behavior, exercising your behavior outside of how you feel. I'll give you a good example of this. I was working with a golfer and he was struggling. Like I was observing a tournament, and I don't know if you watch much golf, but you can see when they start to get really frustrated. I mean, it's no different than really any other sport, but I can just see it written all over his face, and mm-hmm. every shot, he's just like, oh, you can just see it building. You could like cut the tension with a knife, and he's putting and he ends up, you know, missing, or three putting for bogey. And he was pissed, obviously. And he threw down his club, pulled out his driver, practically ran to the next like tee. I had to like pick up my speed to get there. Put down his ball, stepped back, completely erased his pre-shot routine. Like just like that's gone. And just, we watched as he swung and the ball flew directly into a hazard. And he literally let go of his club, walked off the course and quit. So I let him calm down for a little bit, obviously. And later that day we met up for dinner and I asked him, I said, hey, what happened out there?
Yeah.
And he said, you don't understand, Lauren. I don't like losing. That's just who I am. And I stopped him and I said, no, it's not. Mm-hmm. Like kind of shocked and confused. I said, that's not who you are. That's who you're choosing to be. Mm-hmm. I said, that's a very different thing. I said, it's okay to not want to lose.
Yeah.
It's not okay to walk off and quit.
Yeah.
It's okay to be frustrated. It's not okay to throw your club practically at your caddy. It's okay to be fearful. It's not okay to allow fear to dictate your decisions. Mm-hmm. And when you understand the boundaries of where feelings and actions interact, you'll be able to manage it better. But so often we explain away our actions based mm-hmm. on our feelings. And the truth is, like I said earlier, your feelings and actions don't have to match to coexist. You can be pissed off and not say what you're feeling. Mm-hmm. You can be annoyed and not lash out on your teammate. You can have a bad performance and not throw your club. And so I think that when it comes to some of these areas and when we're performing and when things aren't going well, the thing that I see high performers do better than average performers is they solve the in-between. So instead of in between faster, I should say, yeah. I call it solution efficiency. So how quickly you can solve your problems, how mm-hmm. efficient can you be in solving them? Because every performer, whether they are Aaron Judge or whether they just got drafted, every performer deals with highs and lows. Mm-hmm. The difference is somebody like Aaron Judge, it's like this. They're just smaller. The in-between is smaller, where other average performers, there's a much bigger gap between a failure and a recovery.
Yeah.
And so when we're looking at that, then we go, okay, if you can remove a feeling or if you can distance yourself from the feelings you're feeling, what would be the most productive response, action, you know, whether it's a thought or whatever that is, what is the most productive response to move the needle forward? Mm-hmm. And yeah. So that's really what we're looking at when we're looking at how do you help somebody perform? We have to actually honestly separate the emotion from the action and ask ourselves, what typically helps in moments like these?
Yeah.
And I can almost guarantee you walking off and quitting is not one of them.
Yeah. I love that. Like, that really actually speaks to me, in my own life and the work that I do in relationships where it comes to, if you're frustrated, you don't have to lash out. That's a choice. That's a choice of your behavior. You're allowed to be frustrated or be annoyed. But how you respond to that is all on you. And that's a really important thing for everyone to hear, whether it's with your kids, whether it's with, you know, your partner, whether it's with your friends. You can be frustrated, annoyed that something didn't get done the way you wanted, or you're tired or overwhelmed or whatever reason you might feel that way. It doesn't mean you have to then scream and yell at someone just because it might happen. And that's something you try to adjust and change. I know that I have worked on that often when it comes to just my response system. So I love that real thing. You know, the funny thing that I always I always think about, you look at some of the top performance, you know, sports performance coaches and psychologists and people who are involved in that world, a lot of women, right? Mm. How is it being in that room with grown men making millions of dollars who have access to so much and they get everything and they're treated a certain way to be told, hey, stop it. This is how you work. Like, how do you change the dynamic and how do you get them to pay attention when they might think that they're the stuff and that they're be all and end all of a team or the captain or the face of the franchise? How do you create that space of change with someone who might think they don't need to change or that they don't care? And like, they're just like, I'm better than you. I'm, you know, how do you deal with that?
The foundation is all on the relationship. Mm-hmm. There are two situations that I can tell you that are opposite. One where I gave harsh feedback to somebody that I didn't have a relationship with yet. And mm-hmm. I spent the next 3 years rebuilding it. Mm-hmm. That was an early learning in my career. And I was like, that was a big mistake. And I remember in that moment saying, I will never let that happen again. Mm. Because there's a phrase, and I'm going to forget who said it, but I love it, is that you have to build a bridge strong enough that can bear the weight of truth. Mm-hmm. And I hadn't built that bridge with that player yet. Mm-hmm. Having said that, since then, that is like the foundation in which I work off of. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a relationship, there are very few people you can have that kind of hard conversation with that will actually receive it.
Yeah.
I will give you an example. We had this kid that we drafted. He was pretty young, right out of high school. And I was a part of his draft process. And so we already had a relationship before he even started in our system. And he comes in, he's during spring training. He's a pitcher. They throw him in against like double A and triple A hitters. Mm-hmm. Now they knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
They knew he was going to fail. Mm-hmm. And the reason is that they did this. It's a theory, I should say. I don't really know, but this is why I would do it. Is to see how he handles pressure, to see how he handles failure, because he was like the guy until he got dropped. So he gets in there and they're just eating him alive, completely alive. And then of course they take him out. After the game, he comes back to my office and he's like freaking out. He's like in panic mode. He's like, Lauren, I don't know what to do. Like, did you see that? Like, I've never performed like that. Like, what is going on? And just like kind of like just dumping all of his feelings. And so I finally asked him, I said, okay, well, let's go through it. Like, what happened? And he like stops and he's like, honestly, like, I can't even remember. It's almost like he just kind of like everything sped up on him. He kind of like blacked out and like doesn't really remember. And I'm like, that's okay. Like, part of what that tells me is not only the moment dictated that a little bit, but also like, hey, he hasn't failed and he doesn't have a lot of awareness in the moment. So I'm like, that's okay. I was like, what I'm going to have you do is we're going to start with like these journal exercises. Like, if you can notice it after the fact, we're going to start building it closer to the moment. So these are the three questions I want you to ask after every outing or bullpen. And he's like, okay. So he leaves. And later on that day, I'm in the cafeteria. And mind you, it's spring training. Like, everybody's there. Everybody. It's packed. And I'm towards the front of the line and he's at the back and he yells, hey, Lauren. And like the whole place like looks. And he's like, I did my journal exercises. And like, I kind of chuckle. I'm like, sweet, man. And then he goes, ha, just kidding. And the whole room just like went silent. And I just continued to get my food. I went, sat down, I ate. And then I went back to my office and I shot him a text. And I said, don't worry about the journal exercises. And I kid you not, within like 2 minutes, he runs back to my office. And he was like, Lauren, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean don't do the journal exercises? And I said, I don't think you realize. I said, I am not your mom. I'm not your teacher. I am not your friend. I'm your mental performance coach. Whether or not you do the journal exercises does not affect how I go to sleep at night.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to bed, sleep just fine, and I'm going to wake up ready to do my job the next day. And he was like, okay, fine. Like, I'll do them. And I said, no, you're not getting it. I said, do not do it if you're going to do it for me. Only do it if you want to do it for you. Because last time I checked, you came to my office asking for help. You said you wanted to improve and you said you wanted to get better. Mm-hmm. And I said, whether or not you do those journal exercises, again, it does not impact me. The only person it will impact if you choose to do them and you choose to do them correctly is you. Yeah. So when you're ready to take on the responsibility of improvement, please do it. But until then, don't waste your time. Mm-hmm. And he just was like, he just kind of like nodded and he like walked out.
Yeah.
That evening, I got a picture of his journal mm-hmm. and every single outing and bullpen after that. Mm-hmm. He still calls me every spring training to mm-hmm. check in. And it's probably one of the most impressive from the mental perspective turnarounds I've ever seen.
Awesome.
But it was because I had that relationship with him that I was able to tell him the truth.
Yeah.
Our relationship could handle it mm-hmm. to the point now where he's like, shoot, you're right. It yeah. is. And he was able to make that turn. But until then, sure, I can lay down the law and I can say, and there are certain situations where I don't have a relationship where I do have to create boundaries. But for the majority, you have to weigh the cost because the worst mental skill is a forced one. Mm. And so to me, it has to be something where you have the relationship and they're going to be willing to hear it from you, even if they're pissed for a while. I'm willing to sit in that discomfort with them because I want to see them succeed.
I think you're, first of all, a great story. And I think you're really hitting on a huge thing for the helping profession. You know, as a therapist, my style is no BS with lots of compassion. That's who I am. A very straight shooter, very upfront, very real. Because if someone's coming to say, I'm struggling, I'm suffering, I'm not okay, my relationship's on the rocks, whatever it is, me kind of hanging out and being, oh yeah, la-di-da-di-da, and being all nice all the time is not going to get change and help. It doesn't mean I'm not kind, right? I can be real and very kind. And I give my clients warning, like I am not going to just beat around the bush. And if you're not ready for that, let me know. If I push too hard too quick, let me know. But I have to build a relationship with someone. I can't just be like the first session, by the way, your mom did this, your dad did this, this is your issues, here's this, go work on this, you're terrible at this, you're great at that. Like, it's just overwhelming. And the same thing goes for our personal relationships, right? When we first start dating people, we're very hesitant to kind of be real with them. It helps if we're honest and it helps, but to put it on them and kind of be at them. Later on in life relationships, when you've had years of practice and years of understanding and years of caring and kindness of a built bridge, the best relationships are ones that can take it and keep going.
Yep.
And I think it's great because I think something that's so interesting about athletes, especially at the major league stage, whether it's NBA, hockey, NHL, you know, NFL or MLB, right? Or even soccer, all their life, they have been the thing in their elementary school, high school, and college. Everyone has looked at them as the athlete that can take on. It's not just LeBron James who like was the world. But like every small town has those people. You have been the best at every stage, and now you're not. You're right. Just one of many best. And yep. That takes a massive amount of reality check and awareness that you're still great and you're still amazing. You would not be in major league sports if you weren't. But to have someone like you in their corner to get them on that level is unbelievable, and it's probably a lot of, you know, shaky stuff. How, you know, last couple of questions I have, like, how do you change someone's mentality from that winning mentality only to being how well they actually did? Because winning isn't everything, even though in a sport where if you don't win, you might not get, you know, rehired, you might not get a bonus, you might not get recognized for the skill. Like the person I'm thinking of right now, like Mike Trout, right? He's never winning a World Series. No offense, Angels fan. My father-in-law is a massive Angels fan. Like, how do you keep coming back? And how do you keep reminding yourself, I'm freaking Mike Trout, and do greatness and have numbers and all that kind of stuff when you're never winning a World Series?
In my opinion, it comes down to understanding your why behind it all, like the bigger picture. Because baseball is what he does. It's not who he is. you know, basketball is what LeBron does. It's not who he is. You know, tennis is not what Serena was. Obviously, it's what she did. So I think that when we look at that, it's being able to understand the big picture. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, I know that I deal with this a lot with CEOs too. One CEO, it actually struck me. He said, "My whole life, I thought getting to this point is what would make me happy. Mm-hmm. Only to come to find out that it made me happy for a second, and now I feel empty." He said, "What is missing?" And it was the perspective that that really isn't going to make you happy, and that you are so much more than what you do. What you do is fulfilling. It's awesome. You should strive to achieve. You should want to win. You should, you know, you should do all of those things, but while not losing sight of really the importance of this life that we live. And I think that's the human part. That's why I had a Yankees coach come to me, and he said, "Lauren, mindset is everything." And I like paused, and I'm like, I get what he meant, but like there was a big piece missing. And I said, no. Mindset is not everything, but it impacts everything. And that everything it impacts is us as a human being. And I think that having the perspective of at the end of the day, when you're lying on your deathbed, like, what is most important to you? Things that become really highlighted at when we're at the point of losing it. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want my clients to lose that perspective just because you're not on the line of losing it. So I think that when I'm thinking of people like Mike Trout, and I'm thinking of people like the CEO that I work with, I like to really get down to the understanding of like what truly is most important, not in sport, not in one aspect, but of life. Like if you looked back on your life and your deathbed, like what would be most important then? And how are we pouring into that now? Because man, the worst thing and my biggest fear of regret, or my biggest fear is the last thing I want to regret is losing out on relationships and that human connection because I was so focused on winning. And so I think that, you know, that's a long way of saying, I think that there's more to life than just results alone. Although this pursuit gives us some purpose, I think what's really important to understand is the purpose of it all. Because when we're just looking at winning for winning and we're not understanding the purpose that it serves behind it, I think that we can lose a sense of what's most important in life.
So true. Like, so true. I love that. Like, you know, I work with people all the time that struggle with that concept of who they are versus what they do kind of thing, or their feelings defining them as who they are and all that kind of stuff. And I think it's such a beautiful mentality to help people with that balance. You know, yeah, you work with sport athletes and you work with CEOs, but humans are humans. And I think in the past 5 to 10 years, I think the world is starting to realize that just because someone is an athlete or makes billions of dollars as a CEO doesn't mean they don't struggle just as much as the next person who has a job that is hourly or minimum wage, or someone who doesn't have the athletic ability but still struggles with their why and all that kind of stuff. And it's such a beautiful world that you are helping. In the last minute or so, I'd love to hear how you help people get past the wall of performance when they feel stuck. And then I have one more question after that.
The word that comes up for me is alignment. Hmm. I think that whenever, especially like coming from my own perspective, whenever I'm feeling stuck, it's because something's out of alignment. Mm-hmm. So I like to go back and ask the question, like, what is my purpose? What are my core values? Mm-hmm. What's most important to me? And then I like to draw out what exactly my life currently looks like and what my day-to-day looks like. And my mm-hmm. question is, how much of that is reflective of what matters to me? Mm-hmm. And what I find is a lot of times, that when I'm feeling stuck, it's because those two things aren't in alignment. And then the question becomes like, how do I get in alignment? And usually it's a couple of things. Usually it's one, it comes from fear, like fear of change, fear of stepping out of your comfort zone, fear of saying no, fear of saying yes. It usually comes from that, or it comes from fear of failing. Like what I actually want, I'm so afraid to go after. And therefore I've just been staying here for way too long. And so with a lot of my clients, that's what we do is we go back and we look at alignment and we go, okay, what is missing? What are we not doing that is in alignment? And maybe you're doing all the things, but we actually have to eliminate something. Like a lot of times I find that it's addition through subtraction. Sometimes we have to eliminate things to create room, whether it's for ourselves, for our families, for the work that we really truly are passionate about. But that's really where I see a lot of struggle, like is with alignment. So if you're listening to this and you're feeling stuck, my first question would be to ask yourself, like, what do you really want? Like, what's most important to you? And think of it from a very zoomed out perspective. Think of it like, I like to take it no further than like 5 years from now. Like in 5 years, what would you ideally want your life to look like? And not just, look at your job, look at your personal life, look at your relationships, look at like, what car are you driving? Like, what house are you in? Where are you living? Like really look at it from a granular level, but zoomed out. Then ask yourself now, look at your day to day, just take the past 90 days. And say how much of what the way I'm currently living is in reflection with that 5-year vision. And if it's not, the question then becomes, what needs to change? What needs to be adjusted? What decisions do I have to make? What time do I need to sacrifice? Or what things do I need to give up? And I think when we understand that, then we can start to go, okay, now I have a really concrete plan and things that I just need to now go implement. And it's not always easy. That's where some of the fear comes in. That's where some of that work comes in from being able to really get out of your own way. But without understanding direction or without having a direction, really any direction will do. And that's when we feel stuck.
Love that. So powerful. Well, last question I have, and I like to ask, you know, everyone I have on the show, I respect, you know, for what they do, things that I don't do or I'm not, you know, in their world. What would be 1 to 2 things that you would want someone to listen that you haven't said yet? Things that are really impactful that you find help you in your daily life?
I mean, it's such a simple one, but and maybe it's top of mind because I just got off with a client talking about this. But there's 2 questions that have been very, very top of mind. And it does pertain to being stuck. There's this executive going through a merger right now, and he went from being the decision maker to now having to report to 3 people above him. And he's at a point in his career where he's like, I don't even know why I'm still doing this. Like he's frustrated clearly. And I asked him, I said, what are you choosing to hold on to? Because it gives you a sense of control. And there were quite a few things and that he laid out. So for you, if you're listening, like, I want you to answer that question for yourself. Like, what are you choosing to hold on to? Because it gives you a sense of control. And then the second question is, of those things, what can you afford to let go of? Because for him in particular, he felt a little bit out of control. So there was a lot of things he was holding on to solve that out of control feeling. Really, those were the things keeping him stuck and keeping his team in the same position that they were. And so when he was able to let go of some of those things, he was able to make some really great progress within his department and in this new role. Because there are some things that when we spend all of our time and energy and resources on, there's just some things we can't control. Yeah. And when we spend our energy and resources on those things, our effort's wasted. And when we spend them on things that actually can move the needle forward that are within our control, our energy becomes really effective.
Love that. Okay. So where can people find you, get in touch with you, learn from you, hire you, all those wonderful things?
Probably the best place to go would be my website, which is Lauren Nicole John, or whoa, that is not my website, you guys. I don't know whose website that is, but my website is laurenjohnsonandco.com. And that's all spelled out, A-N-D-C-O.com.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for being on the show. Thank you so much for all your, you know, midweek check-ins and all those wonderful things you do with such cool backgrounds. I don't know how you do it, but it always looks so professional and so well done. I'm like, dang, you're doing such a great job. I love it. And I love what you say and what you do. So thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Hey, thanks so much for listening to this week's episode of Dude Therapist Season 5. Can you believe it? I can't. What a journey. Thanks so much for tuning in. Whether it's your first episode you've listened to, or you've been a follower since the beginning, or just trying to catch up, I appreciate you. Thanks so much for really jumping in on this awesome opportunity and learning experience. You know, if you have any questions, ask them. You have thoughts, say them. I didn't finish a thought, or you have more ideas of what you would like to hear, just let me know. The door is open, so to speak, so please walk right in. Tell me what you think. Again, thanks so much for tuning into this week's episode of the Dude Therapist, and hope you tune in next week.